Chapter 34. Six of them walked the dim hallways of Canaan House. Three necromancers, three cavaliers. Every so often they would come across the fallen down body of a skeletal servant, still and grinning emptily up at the ceiling, the chains that had bound them to this tower finally broken. Gideon found the sight of the little heaps and piles weirdly distressing. They had been walking around for 10,000 years probably, and after 2 moments of panic and tragedy, it was all over. The priests of the first house were gone. Maybe it was relief, or maybe it was sacrilege. Gideon wondered what her state of mind would be after a whole myriad. Bored as hell, probably. Desperate to do anything or be anyone else. She would have done everything there was to do, and if she hadn't seen it, she could probably imagine what it looked like. They followed Harrow's map to the hallway of the stopped-up lictor door. The lock still carried the mark of the regenerating bone that had been such a bastard to remove. The stark painting of the waterless canyon had been taken away, and now all three necromancers stood silently before the great black pillars and bizarre carvings above. Silas said,
"I feel no wards here."
Harrow said, "It's a lure."
"Or carelessness," said Palamedes.
"Or they just didn't give a shit, guys," said Gideon, "given that the key is still inside the lock." It was the third door that day they had opened with absolutely no knowledge of what would lie within. The yellow light flooded out into the corridor, and inside. The other two laboratories Gideon had seen were caves. They were practical places to work and sleep and train and eat, homely at best, cheerless at worst, laboratories in the real sense of the word. This room was something else. It had been light and airy once. The floors were made of varnished wood, and the walls were great whitewashed panels. The panels had been painted lovingly a long time ago with a sprawling expanse of fanciful things. White-skinned trees with pale purple blossoms trailing into orange pools, golden clouds thick with flying birds. The room was sparsely furnished, a few broad desks with pots of neatly arranged pencils and books, a polished marble slab with a tidy array of knives and pairs of scissors, what looked to be an ancient chest freezer, some rolled-up mattresses and embroidered quilts, decaying in an open locker at one end. This was all immaterial. Three things caught Gideon's attention immediately. On one of the sweetly painted frescoes, fresh paint marred the blossom-decked trees. Over them, on the wall, black words a foot high proclaimed, "You lied to us!" Someone was crying in the slow, dull way of a person who had been crying for hours already and didn't know how to stop. And Ianthe sat in the centre of the room, waiting. She had taken up position on an ancient and sagging cushion, reclining on it like a queen. Joining a growing trend, her pale golden robes were spattered with blood, and her pallid yellow hair was spattered with more. She was trembling so hard that she was vibrating, and her pupils were so dilated you could have flown a shuttle through them. "Hello, friends," she said. The source of the crying became apparent a little way into the room. Next to the marble slab, Coronabeth was huddled, her arms wrapped around her knees as she rocked backward and forward. Next to her on the ground, "Yes," said Ianthe, "my cavalier is dead and I killed him. Please don't misunderstand. This isn't a confession." Nibirius Tern lay awkwardly sprawled on the ground. His expression was that of a man who had suffered the surprise of his life. There was something too white about his eyeballs, but otherwise he looked perfectly real, perfectly alive, perfectly coiffed. His lips were still a little parted, as if he were going to crossly demand an explanation any minute now. They were stock still. Only Palamedes had the presence of mind to move. He bypassed Ianthe entirely and crossed to where the cavalier lay, stretched out and stiffening. There were blood spatters down his front, a great tear ripped in his shirt. The blade had come through his back. Palamedes reached down, grimaced at something, and shut the man's staring eyes.
"She's right. He's gone," he said.
At this, Silas and Colum came to themselves. Colum drew, but Ianthe gave a sudden shrill trill of a laugh with too many edges.
"Eighth, sort of way," she said. "Oh, Eighth, I'm not going to hurt you."
Ianthe suddenly tucked her knees into her chest and moaned. It was the low, querulous moan of someone with a stomach pain, almost comical.
"This is not how I had envisioned this," she said afterward, teeth chattering. "I am merely telling you, I won."
Gideon said slowly,
"Princess, none of us here speaks crazy lady."
"A very hurtful name," said Ianthe, and yawned. Her teeth started chattering again halfway through, and she bit her tongue, yowled, and spat on the floor. A thin wisp of smoke arose from the mingled spit and blood.
They all stared at it.
"I admit it, this smarts," she said broodingly. "I had my speech all planned out. I was going to brag somewhat, you understand. Because I didn't need any of your keys, and I didn't need any of your secrets. I was always better than all of you, and none of you noticed. Nobody ever notices, which is both my virtue and my downfall. How I hate being so good at my job. You noticed, didn't you, you horrible little ninth goblin? Just a bit."
The horrible little ninth goblin stared at her with tight-pressed lips. She had inched away from Gideon toward the theorem plate, and with no sense of shame began to look it over.
"You knew about the beguiling corpse," Harrow said. "You knew how impossible it was." "Yes, I knew the energy transferal didn't add up. None of the Thanagy signatures in this building added up. Until I realised what we were all being led to. What the lictors of old were trying to tell us. You see, my field has always been energy transferal. Large-scale energy transferal. Resurrection theory. I studied what happened when the Lord, our kindly God, took our dead and dying houses and brought them back to life all those years ago. What price he would have had to pay. What displacement the soul of a planet. What happens when a planet dies?"
"You're an occultist," said Palamedes. "You're a liminal magician. I thought you were an animophiliac."
"That's just for show," said Ianthe. "I'm interested in the place between death and life, the place between release and disappearance, the place over the river, the displacement where the soul goes when we knock it about, where the things are that eat us."
Harrow said, "You make it sound a lot more interesting than it really is."
"Stop being such a bone adept," said Ianthe.
She coughed and laughed again fretfully. She closed her eyes and let her head loll suddenly downward. When she opened them again, the pupil and the iris were gone, leaving the terrible white of the eyeball. They all flinched as Ianthe cried aloud. She closed her eyes tight and shook her head like a rattle, and when she opened them back up, she was panting with exertion, as though she'd just run a race. Gideon remained in a state of flinch. Neither of her eyes were their original colour. Both the pupil and the iris were intermingled shades of brown, purple, and blue. Ianthe closed her eyes a third time, and when the pale lashes opened, both had returned to insipid amethyst. Palamedes had moved to the wall behind Ianthe, flanking her. She did not even bother to turn or notice. She just curled in on herself. Behind Sextus, "You lied to us," stretched out in vast array.
"Step one," she said sing-song, "preserve the soul with intellect and memory intact. Step two, analyze it. Understand its structure, its shape. Step three, remove and absorb it. Take it into yourself without consuming it in the process."
"Oh, fuck," said Hera, very quietly. She had moved back to Gideon's side now, slipping her journal back into her pocket.
"The mega theorem. Step four, fix it in place so it can't deteriorate. That's the part I wasn't sure of, but I found the method here in this very room. Step five, incorporate it. Find a way to make the soul part of yourself without being overwhelmed. Step six, consume the flesh. Not the whole thing. A drop of blood will do to ground you. Step seven is reconstruction, making spirit and flesh work together the way they used to in the new body. And then, for the last step, you hook up the cables and get the power flowing. You'll find that one a walk in the park, Eighth. I suspect it was your house's contribution,"
Palamedes said. "Princess, you never had any keys. You never saw any of these rooms, except this one."
"Like I said," said Ianthe, "I am very, very good, and moreover, I've got common sense. If you face the challenge rooms, you don't need the study notes. Not if you're the best necromancer the Third House ever produced. Aren't I, Corona? Baby, stop crying. You're going to get such a headache."
"I came to the same conclusion you did," said Palamedes, but his voice was cold and inflexible. "I discarded it as ghastly. Ghastly and obvious."
"Ghastly and obvious are my middle names," said the pale twin. "Sextus, you sweet sixth prude. Use that big muscular brain of yours. I'm not talking about the deep calculus. 10,000 years ago, there were 16 acolytes of the King Undying, and then there were 8. Who were the cavaliers to the Lictor faithful? Where did they go?"
Palamedes opened his mouth as though to answer this question, but he had bumped against something on the back wall and had gone still. Gideon had never known him to be still. He was a creature of sudden movement and twitchy fingers. Camilla was watching him with obvious suspicion. One of his thumbs was tracing the edge of a black painted letter, but the rest of his body was rigid. He looked as though someone had turned his power switch off.
But Silas was saying, "None of this explains why you have killed Nibirius Turn."
Ianthe cocked her head to one side, drunkenly, to take him in. The violet of her eyes was dried up flowers. Her mouth was the colour and softness of rocks.
"Then you weren't listening. I haven't killed Nibirius Turn. I ate Nibirius Turn," she said indifferently. "I put a sword through his heart to pin his soul in place. Then I took it into my body. I've robbed death itself. I have drunk up the substance of his immortal soul, and now I will burn him and burn him and burn him, and he will never really die. I have absorbed Nibirius Turn. I am more than the sum of his half and mine."
Her head hung close to her chest again. She gave a hiccup that sounded a little bit like a sob and a little bit like a laugh. As she did, she appeared blurry and indistinct before them, rocking out of her edges, somehow unreal. Gideon's skin had already been crawling, but now it was trying to sprint. Palamedes said, though he sounded as though he were 10,000 years away, "Princess, whatever you think you've done, you haven't done it."
"Oh, haven't I?" said Ianthe.
She rose to stand, but Gideon did not see her move. Ianthe came back to solidity all at once, more real now than anything around her. The room faded into insignificance. She glowed from the inside out like she had eaten a fistful of light bulbs.
"Do you really deny it, even now?" she said. "God, it makes so much sense. Even the rapiers, light swords, light enough to be held by an amateur, a necromancer. Each challenge, fusing, controlling, binding, utilizing. Utilizing whom? Did you notice that none of those challenges could be completed by yourself?" "No, you didn't. And yet that was the biggest red flag. I had to reverse engineer the whole thing just from looking at it, all alone."
Silas sounded quite normal now when he turned and addressed the monotonously crying girl by the slab.
"Princess Coronabeth, is she speaking the truth? And did you, at any point, attempt to stop her, or know as a necromancer what act she was committing?"
"Poor Corona," said Ianthe. "Don't get on her case, you little white excuse for a human being. What could she have done? Don't you know my sister has a bad, sad secret? Everyone looks at her and sees what they want to see. Beauty and power, incredible hair. The perfect child of an indomitable house."
The Crown Prince of Ida was not acknowledging the fact that anyone was speaking to her. Her sister continued,
"Everyone's blind. Corona, a born necromancer. She was as necromantic as Babs, but Dad wanted a matched set, and we didn't want anything to separate us. So we started the lie. I've had to be two necromancers since I was 6. It sharpens your focus, I tell you what. No, Corona couldn't have stopped me becoming a lictor."
Palamedes said vaguely, "This can't be right."
"Of course it's right, Goosey. The Emperor himself helped come up with it."
"So that is lictorhood," said Silas.
He sounded quiet, almost fretful, lost in thought. Gideon thought, just for a moment, that she could see Colm Asht's throat working, that his pupils had dilated just a very, very little.
"To walk with the dead forever. Enormous power, recycled within you from the ultimate sacrifice. To make yourself a tomb."
"You understand, don't you?" said Ianthe.
"Yes," said Silas.
Colm closed his eyes and was still.
"Yes," repeated Silas, "I understand fallibility, and fallibility is a terrible thing to understand. I understand that if the Emperor and King Undying came to me now and asked me why I was not a lictor, I would fall on my knees and beg his forgiveness that any of us had ever failed this test. May I be burnt one atom at a time in the most silent hole, in the most lightless part of space. Lord, kindly prince, should I ever contemplate betraying the compact you appointed between him and you and me?"
Colm opened his eyes again.
"Silas," he began. "I will forgive you eventually, Colm," said his purse-mouthed uncle, "for assuming I would have been prey to this temptation. Do you believe me?" "I want to," said his nephew fervently, with a 1,000-yard stare and his missing finger twitching around his shield. "God help me, I want to,"
Ianthe said contemptuously. "Come off it.
You'd drain him dry if you thought it would keep your virtue intact. This is the same thing, just more humane.
Do not speak to me any more, said Silas. I brand you heretic, Ianthe Tridentarius. I sentence you to death. As your cavalier is no more, you must stand in for him. Make your peace with your house and your emperor, because I swear to the king undying, you will find no more peace in this life anywhere, in any world you care to travel to. Brother Asht.
Hero said, Octokizeron, stop it. This is not the time.
I will cleanse everything here, Ninth, to stop the houses from finding out how we have debased ourselves, said Silas.
His cavalier drew his great sword and slipped his calloused, stumped-up fingers into his targe. He had stepped before them all with an expression of something that was too deep into relief for Gideon to really translate it. His adept said,
Column the Eighth, show no mercy.
Somebody stop him, said Ianthe. Sixth, Ninth, I don't intend for anyone's blood to be spilled. Well, you know, any more.
Hero said, Octokizeron, you fool, can't you see? And Camilla was saying, Everyone back off! But Colum Asht did not back off. He came down on Ianthe like a wolf on the fold. He was terrifically fast for such a big, ragged-looking man, and he hit her with such kinetic force that she should have been flung back to splatter on the wall like a discarded sandwich. His arm was true and steady. There was no hesitation in his hand or in his blade. Neither was there any hesitation in Ianthe's. Gideon had seen the exquisite sword of the Third House lying in a smear of blood next to the body of its cavalier. Now it was suddenly in the hand of its necromantic princess. She met his blade with a flat parry. It knocked away that titanic blow as though Ianthe were not a head shorter and a third of his weight, and she eased back into perfect, sure-footed precision. It was Nibirius Tern's movement that tucked Ianthe's arm behind her back, and Nibirius Tern's perfect, precise footwork. It was profoundly weird to see Nibirius Tern's moves restrung in Ianthe Tridentarius's body, but there they were, recreated right down to the way she held her head. Colum moved in for advantage, a high, vertical cut to her naked collarbones. She avoided his move with boyish contempt and countered. Colum had to scramble to meet her. It was only then that it hit home to Gideon what Ianthe had done. The bizarre sight of a necromancer holding a sword, a ghost fighting inside the meat suit of his adept, made it real that Nibirius was dead, but that he was dead inside Ianthe. It was not that he had taught her how to fight. It was him fighting. There was Nibirius's instant counterstrike. There was Nibirius's gorgeous deflection, the tiny movement knocking Colum's shield away. Normally, Gideon would have been fascinated to watch the Cavalier of the Eighth at work. He was as light on his feet as a feather, and yet his blows were all heavy as lead. But her gaze was locked on Ianthe, only Ianthe, who was moving more Nibirius than Nibirius ever could, whose body was agile and lithe and as suprahuman as a wisp. But there was one catch. The sword of the Third House must have weighed at least a kilogram, and Nibirius's muscle memory could not quite account for Ianthe's arms. Some power must have been compensating for her body. Her elbow should have been locking like a door. But whatever she was doing to wield that thing, it was just a fraction not good enough. She was sweating. There was a pucker in the middle of that preternaturally calm forehead, a wince in the eyes, the slight drunken lolling of the head that she had suffered from before. As she faded, Colum took the advantage. She shook herself, and he raised his foot and kicked her sword out of her hand. It spun over to the wall where Palamedes had been and cluttered there miserably, far out of reach. Colum raised his sword. The princess of the Third House raised her hand to her mouth, gored a chunk of flesh from the heel of her palm and spat it at him like a missile. Ianthe disappeared beneath a greasy, billowing tent, cellular, fleshy, coated all over with neon yellow bubbles and thin pink film. Colm bounced off this thing as though he had hit a brick wall. He went ass over tea kettle and rolled over and over, only at the last skidding back up to stand, locking himself into position, panting. Where there had been a necromancer, there was instead a semi-transparent dome of skin and subcutaneous fat, baffling to the eye. Nothing loath, Colm charged again, smashing his shield down on it with a bad wet noise like squirk. It was rubbery. It bounced back against him. He gave a mighty slash downward with his sword. The flesh bubble tore and bled, but did not give. Gideon put her hand on her sword to draw it and slipped her fingers into her gauntlet. Thin fingers wrapped around her wrist. When she looked around, Hera was tight-lipped. "Don't go near them," she said. "Don't touch her. Don't think about touching her." Gideon looked around wildly for the sixth house. She found only Camilla, swords sheathed, face impassive. Those watching were doing so in near embarrassed, breathless silence as Colm circled the horrible skin shield, testing it with slashes, shoving his blade home hard and grunting when the flesh did not give. Then Silas closed his eyes and said quietly,
"The necromancer must fight the necromancer."
Colm raised his arm for a beautiful downward cross slice, then jerked back as though he had been stung. He retreated, sword and small shield at the ready, and gritted his teeth. Gideon now knew what leeching felt like, and swore to God she could see the haze in the air and feel the chilly suction as his necromancer began to siphon.
"Stop fighting me," said Silas, without opening his eyes.
Colm said gruffly,
"Don't do it. Don't put me under. Not this time." "Brother Asht," said his necromancer, "if you cannot believe, then for God's sake, obey."
Colm made a sound in the back of his throat. Ianthe was visible as a blurred shape behind the yellow-streaked flesh wall. Silas walked forward on light feet, crackles of electricity arcing over his skin, his hands, and laid his palms on the shield. The skin puddled around his fingers, and for a moment, Gideon thought it was working. Then the wall sucked his hands inward, ripping and bristling with canine teeth. The shield bit down savagely, and there was blood at Silas's wrists. He cried out and then closed his eyes, the heat pouring off him in waves. Colm went greyer and greyer and stiller, and Silas squeezed his hands into fists. The shield went pop, like a pimple or an eyeball, and fell to the floor in ragged strips and jiggling globs. Silas looked almost surprised to see Ianthe, who was gripping her head in tight-knuckled hands. When Ianthe looked up, her eyes were wild and white again, and she screamed in a voice that required many more vocal cords than she possessed. Silas approached her with hands like hot white murder. Ianthe ducked past him and flung herself down onto one of the still bubbling sheets that had made up her shield. She sunk down into the skin with a splash, peppering the wooden floor with hot yellow fat. The skin blistered and crinkled up on itself like it had been burnt, and then it deliquesced into a viscous puddle, leaving no trace of Ianthe. Silas knelt by the puddle and, silver chains starting to warp and buckle on his perfect white tunic, thrust his hand into it. Colm made a noise as though he had been punched in the gut. A bloodied hand emerged from the puddle, seized Silas by the shoulder and jerked him in. The ceiling broke apart like a thundercloud, and a torrent of bloody, fatty rain sluiced down on them all. Gideon and Harrow gagged and pulled their hoods down over their heads. Two figures tumbled from above, filthy with blood and lymph. Ianthe landed on her feet and delicately shivered off the fetid red soup, more or less unblemished, while Silas fell heavily to earth. There was a faint red mark like a slap on Ianthe's face. She touched her cheek, and it paled into nothing. Silas clambered to his knees, clasped his fingers together, and the feeling of suction popped the pressure in both of Gideon's ears. She saw his power warping around Ianthe now, and she gave a disbelieving laugh. She was breathing hard, almost hyperventilating.
"Octa Kizeron," Ianthe said. "You can't take it faster than I can make it."
"He's trying to drain her," muttered Hero, spellbound. "But he's splitting his focus. He needs to bring Colum back, or..."
Colum, ashen as his name, drunk in movement, numb, had lifted his sword and was moving inexorably toward Ianthe. He backhanded her full across the face with his shield, as though to test her. Ianthe's head snapped back, but she looked more dazed and surprised than hurt or injured. Her breath was coming in stutters. She righted herself like nothing had happened, and the cavalier thrust forward with his blade. She raised her hand and wrapped it around the shining edge like it was nothing. Her hand was bloody, but the blood itself pushed back gracefully, quietly repelling the blade like it was all just so many more fingers. Silas clasped his hands together, and the pressure nearly made Gideon hurl. Colum shook his sword. The blood broke off like shards of glass, and Ianthe staggered, though nobody had touched her. As she lurched away from Colum, the blood on the floor and the walls and the ceiling was drying up, burning into itself as though it had never been. Her eyes were that awful blank white, and she was holding her head and shaking it as though to reposition her brain.
"Stop doing this to me," she was hissing. "Stop it."
Colum turned, and with a liquid, exquisite movement, sliced down across her back. It was a shallow cut. Ianthe did not even seem to notice. The blood bubbled over her pretty yellow robe, and the new gash revealed the wound sucking in on itself and zipping together.
"Listen,"
she was saying.
"Perhaps, listen."
Silas slammed his fists on the ground. The air was choked from Ianthe's lungs. Her mouth and skin puckered and withered. She stopped, awkward, stiff, eyes bulging in surprise. The remnants of blood rose from the floor as pale smoke, trailing heavenward all around them. For a moment, everything was blanched clean and luminously white. In the middle of all this stood Ianthe, unnaturally still and bent. Blood dripped calmly out of Silas's nose and ears in the blood sweat. Gideon felt Harrow flinch. Ianthe's pallid purple irises had returned, and so had the pupils, though perhaps all a little paler than before. She was aging before their eyes. Her skin sloughed off in papery threads, but she was not staring at Silas, who held her as firmly as though he had her clasped in his hands. She was staring, disbelieving, at Colum the Eighth.
"Well, now you are fucked," she announced.
Colum the Eighth's eyes were as liquid black as, before, Ianthe's had been liquid white. He had stopped moving as a human being did. The warrior's economy of movement, the long and lovely lines of someone who had trained with the sword his whole life, the swift-footedness was gone. He now moved like there were six people inside him, and none of those six people had ever been inside a human being before. He sniffed. He craned his head around and kept craning. With an awful crack, his head turned 180 degrees to look impassively at the room behind him. One of the light bulbs screamed, exploded, died in a shower of sparks. The air was very cold. Gideon's breath came as frosty white frills in the sudden darkness, and the remaining light struggled to pierce the gloom. Colum licked his lips with a grey tongue. Particles of bone bounced along the floor. Harrowhark had thrown them in a long overhand arc, and they fell true at Colum's feet. Spikes erupted from the ground, crowding Colum between them, locking him in tight. Colum raised his white-booted foot indifferently and kicked through them.
They exploded into dusty, tooth-coloured clouds of calcium.
Silas looked up, nearly fetal from the floor. He still glowed like a pearl in a sunbeam, but he'd lost his focus.
Ianthe stepped out of his spell disdainfully, flesh plumping, colour coming back to her face, and she itched herself.
There were lights beneath Column the Eighth's skin.
Things pushed and slithered along his muscles as he walked, heavy-footed, rocking from side to side. Silas wiped the blood away from his nose and mouth and said calmly,
"Brother Asht, listen to the words of the head of your house."
Column advanced.
"Come back," said Silas, unruffled. "I bid you return. I bid you return. Column, I bid you return. I bid you return. I bid you return. I bid, I bid, I bid, I bid. Column."
The thing that lived in Column raised Column's sword and drove the point through Silas Octokizeron's throat. Gideon moved. She heard Hero shout a warning, but she couldn't help it. She drew her rapier from its scabbard and she threw herself at the grey thing wearing a person's skin. It was not a cavalier. It did not meet the arc of her sword with a parry. It just clouted her with Column's shield with a strength no human being ever had. Gideon staggered, very nearly fell, ducked out of the way of a sword gracelessly slammed downward. She took advantage of his movement, got up close, pinned his arm between her body and her sword, and shattered his wrist with a meaty crack. The thing opened its mouth and opened its eyes right up in her face. Its eyeballs were gone. Column's eyeballs were gone. And now the sockets were mouths ringed with teeth, with little tongues slithering out of them. The tongue in his original mouth extended out, down, wrapping itself around her neck.
"Enough," said Ianthe.
She appeared behind the grey thing that had been Column. She took its twisted neck in her hands as calmly and easily as though it were an animal, and she tilted it. The neck snapped. Her fingertips dipped inside the skin. The eye mouths shrilled, and the tongue around Gideon's neck flopped away, and both those mouths dissolved into brackish fluid. The body dropped to the floor. And it was Column again. Face disfigured, neck on the wrong way, sprawled over the pierced shell of his young dead uncle. There was no solace in that big, beat-up body, clutched around his necromancers in morbid imitation of the whole of their lives. Neither of them wore white anymore. They were stained all the way through, yellow, red, pink. The lights buzzed again dismally. The air cleared. Ianthe was left among the gore looking like a moth, fairy-like. She picked up the hem of her skirts delicately and shook them. The blood and muck came off like it was powder. The Princess of Ida beheld the mess around her. Then she slapped herself very lightly, like you would to wake someone up. "Get it together," she told herself. "You nearly lost that." She turned to Gideon, Camilla, and Harrow, and she said, "There are worse things than myself in this building. Have that one for free." Then she stepped backward into the puddled spray of Silas's blood and disappeared. They were left alone in the room with the quiet, stretched-out corpses of Silas Octokizeron, Column Asht, and Nibirius Tern, and the low, dreary breathing of Coronabeth Tridentarius, looking like chopped-up jewellery. Gideon lurched toward her, out of desperation to move away from the middle and what was in it, to move toward the abandoned third twin. Corona looked up at her with tears on her beautiful lashes and eyes swollen from crying. She threw herself into Gideon's arms and she sobbed silently now, utterly destroyed. Gideon was soothed by the fact that someone in this madhouse was still human enough to cry.
"Are you okay? I mean, are you all right?" said Gideon.
Corona recoiled from Gideon and looked up at her, her golden hair smeared to her forehead with sweat and tears.
"She took Babs," she said,
which seemed fair enough.
But then Corona started crying again, big tears leaking out of her eyes, her voice thick with misery and self-pity.
"And who even cares about Babs? Babs! She could have taken me,